another edition of the Falklands War series podcast of Sea Control from the East Atlantic. My name is Alex Clark, and today in this podcast we are hosting Tim Gedge, Commander Tim Gedge, RN retired, who during the Falklands War had a very, very eventful time. He raised the squadron in 21 days and took it to war, and then came back from war and raised the squadron again to take it down south on HMS Illustrious to play a replacement install. This is a history, this is a story which is worth listening to, and I hope you find it very, very useful. I certainly did.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writing directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
So, Tim, let's start off with your personal background. Where did you come from? What made you want to join the Royal Navy and be a pilot?
Do you know, when I left school with A-levels, I'd gone into industry to be an engineer on a thick sandwich course and with a firm. I spent a year with them, and they sent me to university. And it was actually at university that I started flying in a university air squadron, of course, run by the Royal Air Force at that stage. But I very quickly found that flying was something that I could do. It came easily, and I greatly enjoyed it. And eventually I joined the Royal Navy because it seemed to me that a combination of flying and ships was something that really appealed. My first frontline squadron was flying the Sea Vixen, flying off aircraft carriers in the Far East. And following that, I became a flying instructor, spending much of my early flying instructor days at the Air Warfare School at Royal Naval Air Station Lossiemouth in Scotland. And I later became an A-category flying instructor. From Lossiemouth, I joined the first frontline F-4 Phantom Squadron, embarked in Ark Royal, again as the flying instructor, and then came to the end of my 8 years. And one of the reasons I'd become a flying instructor was because that was going to be more valuable with the airlines, so I thought, and would give me an easier transition into the civil flying world. But at that stage, I was prevailed upon to stay in the Royal Navy, and I transferred to a full career generalist commission. And part of my requirement, really, to stay in the Navy was I wanted to be an air warfare instructor. To me, flying the aircraft was one thing, but actually in military flying, the real requirement is to be able to fight the aircraft. And the air warfare instructor, the AWI in the Royal Navy, was the king as far as fighting was concerned. So I did the AWI course and actually ended up as the last senior pilot or second in command of the air warfare instructor school back at Lossiemouth. And following that, I then went back to sea in the frontline Phantom Squadron as the senior pilot, and left there to be the aviation officer at Britannia Royal Naval College at Dartmouth, and followed that by being the air liaison officer for 3 Commando Brigade Royal Marines. I did the staff course after that, and then came back to flying, back to aviation to fly the Sea Harrier, and took over as the commanding officer of the first frontline Sea Harrier Squadron, number 800 Naval Air Squadron. So I felt that I'd had a pretty varied and fairly complete background to flying at this stage.
What was it like flying the Sea Vixen?
The Sea Vixen was a really interesting aeroplane, and I think the a number of things come to mind. Age 22, to be in a frontline aircraft carrier in the Far East, flying a huge aeroplane, was just hugely exciting. The fact that the aeroplane was really rather too big for the aircraft carriers we had it on was not the point. We didn't know any better. And it was certainly a challenge to fly, but my goodness, what a really exciting aeroplane.
It's always been one of my favourite aircraft, the Sea Vixen. I had a big picture of it on my wall from when I was younger. Right, so we've gone through your background leading up to your experiences and sort of what had happened to you prior to the war. What was your first thing that went through your mind when you heard about the Falklands War and when you heard you yourself were going for it? How did you hear that you were going to be going down there?
I was actually, the morning that it all sort of kicked off, I was actually called out of a conference room in Gosport, where a very large number of officers and ratings were being told by the Admiral that there was a redundancy program being announced. And a large number of those present, and there were some hundreds there, were going to be handed redundancy letters that day, brown envelopes. I was actually called out of this conference and, to my surprise, told to report to the Commander-in-Chief Fleet at Northwood, outside London, in 30 minutes' time. And clearly this was impossible, even for somebody who had a control over aircraft. So I actually borrowed a staff car and drove myself to Northwood and arrived something over 2 hours later. Fortunately, having listened to the radio on the way up, the first question that the Commander-in-Chief Fleet staff put to me was, how many ships and aircraft would the Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla, and I was on the FOF 3 staff this time, how many ships and aircraft would the Admiral want to send on an operation? Now, kind of strange question, and my question, of course, was, what is the operation and where? And I was told very firmly at this stage that my security clearance was not high enough to know this. So I said in response that, well, assuming that the opposition of the Argentines in the Falkland Islands, and I got some pretty peculiar glances when I said that, but as I say, I had fortunately listened to the radio on the way up, and there was the inkling of things that were going on down south. Then I said we will send all the aircraft carriers and all the Sea Harriers that we had, knowing fully well that we only had two aircraft carriers, Hermes and Invincible, and 20 Sea Harriers. And I was then asked, well, how would I divide it up? And I said, well, we have two frontline squadrons. They're complemented for eight aircraft each. So we'll actually put one squadron in Invincible with eight aircraft, and we will put the other squadron in Hermes with 12. We'll augment the existing squadron with four from the headquarters squadron. And the headquarters squadron was an 800 series squadron, the significance of that being that 700 series squadrons in the Royal Navy are training, and 800, albeit they may be in a training role, but they are actually complemented and provisioned with war stock. So we could easily send an 800 training squadron to sea to war. I'd had the advantage, of course, of having embarked my 800 squadron in 1980 for some months in HMS Invincible. Invincible in 1980, and then in HMS Hermes in 1981. So I'd spent some months at sea in both those ships, so I actually knew a little bit about what I was talking about. After this really rather extraordinary interview, I got back in the car, drove to Portsmouth, and to my surprise found that all the senior Flag Officer 3rd Flotilla, the FOF 3 staff, had actually been deployed to FOF 1 staff and were on their way to Gibraltar. And I found this at the time really quite extraordinary, because the FOF-3 was actually the owner of the aircraft carriers, but perhaps more particularly, he actually owned the amphibious ships as well. He was the his old title was Flag Officer Carriers and Amphibious Ships. The Commodore Amphibious Warfare, in this case Mike Clapp, actually reported to FOF-3 as his senior officer. So it seemed nonsensical to me that we would actually be sending FOF-1 on an operation. An anti-submarine admiral with a small but very specialist anti-submarine staff, with very little aviation experience on his staff. But more particularly, they'd never actually exercised in aircraft carriers or with amphibious ships. So to me, things were, this was curious. And with the benefit of hindsight now, of course, 33 years later, I think I can understand some of the reasoning, perhaps, why we sent the FOF-1. And it might be wrong to overemphasize this, because the bottom line was, that, of course, that we won the war. But had we not won, I think some very serious questions would have been asked, which would have been very difficult to answer. And I think there's a real message for the future there, that actually we probably got it very wrong at that stage. And I think a lot of things that happened during the conflict itself actually stemmed from that initial decision. My second irritation at this stage was that I was personally not going. And I felt actually this was grossly unfair, as I'd just handed over command of 800 Squadron. And it seemed to me the only person who wasn't going was me. Of course, you know, we would never recall somebody for an operation and change command. But I was a bit miffed about this. I have to say that my dismay was relatively short-lived, because on the Monday, having watched the squadrons embark and the ships sail, I was actually telephoned personally by the admiral in charge of naval aviation, who asked in a rather nice way if I would like to go back to Yeovilton to form a new squadron. A delightful way of putting it from Admiral, Rear Admiral Ted Anson, who was the Flag Officer, Naval Air Command. And I have to say, I find it difficult to stop grinning, to say yes, sir, and salute down the telephone all at the same time.
So, this squadron you formed up, that was 809 Squadron, correct?
Yes, that was 809 Squadron.
And how did you go about that? What was your time frame? What was your abilities? What were you calling on to form this squadron in wartime? Where did you get the aircraft, for starters, and the pilots?
It was... following the telephone call with Ted Anson, I found myself sitting in front of him, the 0800, the following morning. And he gave me a very explicit and simple remit. He said, go to Yeovilton Airfield, the other side of the road from his quarters, find yourself an office, find yourself all the aircraft you can and the pilots, and be ready to deploy operationally in 21 days. Now, at that stage, we identified 10 Sea Harriers spread about all over the UK, some in deep maintenance, some were test aircraft at Boscombe Down, and some were in build, one in advanced stage build at Dunsfold. I could actually identify 10 pilots, but I was told very explicitly at this stage that I could not take the Australian Navy exchange pilot, who would have been invaluable. He'd been in my 800 squadron, and he was an air warfare instructor. Neither could I take the U.S. Marine Corps exchange pilot. Also, I was told I had to leave a Navy test pilot to continue test flying, and a qualified flying instructor behind, in order so that we could actually continue training if everybody was lost down south. I mean, and by that, of course, the implication was that it was not just aircraft, but the pilots as well. So I had 8 Sea Harriers, but at this stage, only just 6 pilots. And Admiral Ted asked me what I thought, and I said, well, if I was given a current Harrier pilot from the Royal Air Force with a background of single-seat radar-equipped fighter background, i.e. Somebody who'd flown the Lightning on a first tour, mm-hmm. we could bring them up to speed in a couple of weeks, which was all we had now available in my three-week remit. The only two who fitted this bill, I was told, were at RAF Gütersloh in Germany, and I think they were surprised to be airborne in a Sea Harrier at Yeovilton within 48 hours of being told the good news that they would go to war with the Navy. During that 3 week period, I had a pretty free hand to ask for anything that I wanted. I think my difficulty at this stage was knowing really what to ask for. In other words, to be able to stand back enough to actually think outside the box, in a sense. One of the things, and I've got a few examples I can sort of run by you here. I was asked, one of the things I asked for was a brief on the capabilities of the Argentine Air Force and the Argentine Navy, which was a pretty obvious request, I think. And a senior civil servant from the Defense Analyst Center at West Byfleet came, and he was going to brief my pilots on his findings. Fortunately, I asked him to come and have a cup of coffee in my office before he actually gave the brief and tell me in a nutshell what he was going to say. And he actually said that he was all his findings said that we were going to lose all the Sea Harriers by the end of day two in a shooting war. They would all be shot down.
Positive of him.
This was totally ridiculous as far as I was concerned, and I simply wasn't prepared to have that sort of nonsense briefed to people that I was trying to train up to go to war. So I thanked him for his time and actually had to have him escorted out of the building. Fortunately, I was able to bring one of my chief petty officers out, who was acting as master at arms, and he virtually had to physically manhandle him out of the building. He was apoplectic, this chap, threatening me with all sorts of disasters. But I had the sense to phone the captain of Yeovilton, saying that it was likely he was going to hear at some stage from a very irate senior civil servant complaining of my actions. And as I was explaining this over the phone to the captain of Yeovilton, he said, "Tim, I think he's just arrived." Anyway, that was the end of that one. Another thing I asked for was to practice air combat against the French Super 8 on Dard aircraft and also against the Mirage 3s. And to my intense disgust, the French Air Force flew their aircraft and the French Navy to Royal Air Force airfields well away from Yeovilton. And we didn't even get the chance really to discuss the capabilities. I mean, we could have really done with that conversation about the Super 8 on Dard. I knew a certain amount about it. I'd actually been over to France and I'd met French Navy pilots, but this was a bit earlier. And we didn't get the chance to do any practice air combat with them or the Mirage. And I think this is an example of actually very muddled thinking at this stage in the senior level in the MOD. I suspect heavily influenced by the Royal Air Force, who wanted to get in on the act, and that was quite understandable, but actually it wasn't helpful to me. I also, and another example, I asked for some air-to-air refueling practice with Victor tankers, because it seemed likely that we were going to want to fly down to Ascension Island from Yeovilton, as opposed to embarking in Atlantic Conveyor in Plymouth. And since we hadn't refueled the Sea Harrier before, in-flight refueled, we clearly needed some practice. And I was told that that all the pilots had to go on a week's ground school course with the Royal Air Force before we could even get into the air and try it in the air. I mean, what nonsense this was. You know, the last thing I could afford was to send everybody on a week's course. We were working up for war. And clearly, some elements of MOD were working in peacetime rules and others were not. I actually sent a signal under my own signature saying that all my Sea Harrier pilots were qualified in in-flight refueling and in date. And I needed a Victor tanker overhead Yeovilton at 20,000 feet the following morning. The Victor tanker duly arrived. We had fitted the in-flight refueling probes onto the Sea Harrier for the first time. And we took off, and each one of us plugged in, took a suck of fuel, and it was a complete success. And that was the last time we actually saw a tanker until we deployed to Ascension Island later in the month. So, and then another thing was, I'd asked the Admiral how on earth we were actually going to get to war, and he said, don't worry about that, you get on and work the squadron up. It became very evident very early on that the Atlantic conveyor has been taken up from trade and was actually in dock at Devonport. And I went down on a Saturday morning with the then Captain Mike Layard, who was to be the senior naval officer aboard, and went around the upper deck with a with someone with a chalk stick, marking things to be cut off or left. And we decided to leave containers at the side of the deck to provide some sort of weather protection. And at the very last moment, because they were about to start cutting the foremost off and the weather protection, I said, no, for goodness sake, you've got to leave all that, and particularly leave the mast. And there was quite some discussion. People said, well, it will get in the way of landing. And I said, look, the only way we are ever going to be able to land in this ship is actually to have some sort of reference point up forward. That mast has to stay. I mean, the reason being, you simply can't see below you when you're landing in a Sea Harrier. And when you do a vertical landing onto a pad ashore, you have reference points ahead and to the side of the aircraft that you line yourself up on. And clearly this wouldn't work at sea because you can't put poles in the ocean. As soon as I got back to Yeovilton on that day from Atlantic Conveyor, I actually asked for a crane to be parked on the runway with its jib extended at a 10-degree angle and to a height of 85 feet. I was getting pretty well anything I asked for, so there were no questions asked as to why I wanted it, but it seemed pretty strange to everybody that we wanted a crane parked on the runway. But anyway, there it was, following morning. The driver of the crane refused to leave his cab because he said he couldn't have the jib extended, engine running without him there. So I had to get him into my office and explain that unfortunately there was a Sea Harrier hovering on the runway not too far away. And I said, look, you've got 10 tons of very, very hot air, and that is going to be coming out of that aeroplane, and it's going to be about 10 or 12 feet in front of you. I don't think you want to be there. He got the message actually very quickly, abandoned his rule book, and assured, and I had to assure him that we would be responsible for the damage to his crane. And my team fed him coffee while I went out and hovered a Sea Harrier at the top of his crane, about 10 or 12 feet away from it. And then did a vertical landing, actually coming back at 10 degrees to land right by the crane. It worked a dream. And that, of course, was the way that we did it aboard Atlantic Conveyor. And indeed, all my pilots actually went out and had a practice on the crane that day. So that was some of the things. Now, 8 days after I'd actually been first down to Atlantic Conveyor, I actually flew down there. Atlantic Conveyor by this time had fully stored and was at sea. She was actually swinging around Charlie Boy inside Plymouth Breakwater. And I carried out three landings approaching from different directions. And after the third vertical takeoff, from Atlantic Conveyor. I called up Yeovilton and said that the trial was a complete success, and landed, I have to say, very short of fuel at this stage at Plymouth Roeburgh Airport. This woke them up because it was 11 o'clock, around 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. So I had a quick coffee there with the Naval College students, because that was where we did our flying grading from the Naval College. I knew certainly all the instructors there. And I refueled and flew back to Yeovilton. And as I flew back, I could see Atlantic Conveyor actually heading out to sea beyond Plymouth Breakwater. She had been dispatched to war. So that was one of the quickest trials ever, I think, of an aircraft carrier. And I think the final example I thought I would mention was the we did trials of the AIM-9 Lima Sidewinder missile. These weren't in service, Royal Naval Service at the time, and indeed we planned, a trial had been planned for later in 1982. And I actually sent two aircraft up to Royal Air Force Valley with very explicit instructions for them to remain there until they had fired six missiles successfully. I was told this would take some time. The original trial had been planned to take place over many weeks. My Australian air warfare instructor and a very small team were there. They achieved six missiles in just under 2 days. And actually, that must have saved the Treasury a huge sum of money in expensive trials. So that was sort of part of the of the workups that we did in that 3 week period.
Oh, thank you. That's very good. So you flew out from Yeovilton to Ascension, and then went on to the Atlantic Conveyor. What was that flight like? Because that must have been a long time to be in a very small cockpit.
Yes, it was. I think just going back a brief stage, it was. Of course, we could have embarked in Atlantic Conveyor in Plymouth and simply sailed south in her. But actually, I needed the extra time at Yeovilton to train the two RAF pilots to actually get all these trials and everything else done. So it made much more sense to fly down to Ascension. It was going to take Atlantic Conveyor 10 or 12 days to get down to Ascension. And I needed that time. In fact, desperately needed it. We then started planning how we would get to Ascension. I had an idea that we could actually do it by island hopping sort of Azores and Canaries and all that sort of thing. And we might just about have been able to do it, but actually it wasn't arguably the most sensible thing to do. So we actually asked for the Victor tankers so that we could in-flight refuel. And I said that it was probably better for us to stop en route as opposed to fly what would have been about 9 hours or so. We'd never flown the Sea Harrier for more than about an hour and 45 minutes at that stage. And there were some unknowns, things like, oil supplies to the engine, but maybe the liquid oxygen supplies, which actually were slightly different in the Sea Harrier to the original RAF Harriers. So it made a lot of sense to me that we stopped. So we flew 6 hours down to Banjul in Gambia, and then another 3.5 hours onto Ascension. But the really irritating thing to me was that having decided that we would not embark in Atlantic Conveyor and we would go 10 or 12 days later down to Ascension, I was actually told that I had to go at the end of that week in about 4 days' time, 5 days' time, because the Royal Air Force weren't able to produce any Victor tankers for us a week later. Now, this, to some extent, scuppered my plan, and it was extremely frustrating to me because nobody would tell me why we couldn't have the tankers, and it seemed to me that actually we ought to have a fair priority on tankers. There was something like 23 Victor tankers available, and I didn't actually need that many. Of course, when we arrived at Ascension, it was immediately apparent why they weren't available, because they were the first Vulcan raids on Stanley were about to take place. This has, I have to say, coloured my thinking hugely on the Victor, the Vulcan raids on Stanley. And while I hugely admire the courage and the very, very clever planning that went into it, in my view, the missions were a complete waste of time and effort, and they actually fouled up an awful lot of what should have been achieved at Ascension. I mean, there was my delay, which I could have really done with at Yeovilton, but there were lots of other things that actually were screwed up as a function of having this very, very large number of very big airplanes at Ascension. Huge problems. And actually, with the benefit of hindsight again, actually carrying 63 bombs all the way down to Stanley and getting one bomb on the side of the runway is not really a demonstration of capability. And I actually don't think it did anything at all to affect the Argentine flying operations. So I think, in fact, the flying down to Ascension for us was simply a matter of flying in company with Victor tankers, and we did, I can't remember how many in-flight refuelings, it was probably something like 18 or 20. We simply kept ourselves amused by topping up three aircraft on one Victor, and we took it in turns, just went in one after the other and plugged and topped the tanks up. So it was a very simple operation. We didn't even have to navigate. The Victors did the navigation there. My only slightly amusing thought afterwards was that when we went on down to Ascension, they actually turned around and went back when we were something like 500 miles from Ascension. And of course, we had to navigate that that way over the sea, but that's by the way.
That's still an amazing operation. So, once you're at Ascension, how long were you there for before you joined Atlantic Conveyor and you took your aircraft to her?
We were actually in Ascension for the inside of a week. I think it was six days. It might have been 7 days. And with absolutely nothing to do. I mean, the aircraft were parked on this very, very dusty airfield, with an awful lot of volcanic ash being blown around, in particular by the Victor operations and all the helicopter. And so it was a lot of dust and gritty dust, which actually worried me. And so we made every effort to try and block every hole in the Sea Harrier and intakes and everything else to stop this getting in. But it was not ideal having Sea Harriers parked there. And there was actually nothing for us to do. We didn't want to fly at that stage, or at least it would have been difficult to fly, actually virtually impossible with the very large number of other aircraft that there were there. So it was just frustrating to me.
When did the GR3s join you? Because I know they were put onto Atlantic Conveyor as well. So how did they fly down with Victors, or did they just join Atlantic Conveyor at the beginning? How did they get there?
They flew down to Ascension and then lifted on board, flew themselves on board at Ascension. The whole thing went, the whole business of embarking the Harriers, Sea Harriers went without incident. It was, and actually that was a very good, I mean, the Royal Air Force did very well. I mean, their pilots had never been to sea before. They'd never landed a ship they knew nothing about it, and they did well getting themselves on board the way they did.
Were you asked to give them any sort of briefing or anything to help them? Because like with you, had worked out the mast and using that as your sort of your guide to land on a ship. Were you asked to give them any hints, to give them any tips to help them with those sort of things?
Yes, we'd done, all the RAF pilots had been to Yeovilton, and they'd actually flown their GR3s up the ski jump at Yeovilton Airfield. And they could, we could adjust the ramp there from either the 8 degrees or the 12 degrees in Hermes, 8 degrees being an invincible. So they'd all done ski jump launch practice at Yeovilton. They'd had a certain amount of sort of teach-ins there, but during the 12-day passage from Ascension down to the total exclusion zone, every other day, I had the OC of one squadron, Peter Squire, and his second in command with me and my team in Atlantic Conveyor. The rest of the other four pilots were in the Norland, a North Sea ferry that was following along behind us. And every other day we brought those four over, plus the odd maintainer, engineer. And we had a sort of teach-in at some length in Atlantic Conveyor. And we tried to dump all the knowledge that we, between us, had learned over the years onto them about what flying with the Royal Navy was all about and what operating at sea was about. At this stage, of course, the GR3s had initially been planned to go down there purely as attrition replacements. The idea that they would actually fly operationally, as far as I was concerned, hadn't really been considered. It may have been considered by them, but it wasn't, that wasn't part of the overall plan. But it then, it seemed very obvious to a lot of us that, actually, they were an asset that really should be used in their primary role, and that would then free the Sea Harriers up for the Sea Harriers' primary role, which was really air defence. That indeed was the way that it that operated. Now, one of the problems that, of course, the Air Force had was that their aircraft, the alignment of their weapon system was simply not designed to work at sea. I mean, there was an instant fix to that problem that was dreamt up, and that worked, I think, reasonably well. But it was a bit of a lash-up. And I think that, again, with retrospect, we were beginning to work out problems at this stage by taking people on an operation that were totally unworked up, and actually were doing something which was totally alien to them. And I think this is one of the messages that comes out of the war to me. Now, there were very good reasons, as I've said, why we wanted the GR3s there, and those were actually as attrition replacements. Had we actually said at the outset we were going to take the RAF Harriers down there to do operational attack missions, and had we been so worried about losing all the Sea Harriers in the first 2 days, as our nice chap from West Byfleet said, then we might perhaps have rethought the whole business about taking one squadron to sea. In the event, I think they did astonishingly well and acquitted themselves really remarkably well, despite the huge problems of that they had operating from a totally a different type of airfield. I mean, from an aircraft carrier, lack of experience in naval operations. They flew 126 operational missions. They flew about 150 in total while they were down south. And that compares with about 1,700 for the Sea Harriers. So it was considerably less than 10%. And the Sea Harriers did about three times as many attack missions, dropping weapons, firing weapons against land troops, Argentine troops, than the RAF Harriers did. So if you, to put it in context, and with the benefit of hindsight, I'm not convinced that taking the Royal Air Force to sea was the best thing. But of course, at the time, it was the right decision to do, and I applaud the way that they got on and achieved what they did do.
Okay, thank you. So, was it? Well, there's sort of two questions. What was it? So, traveling. What was the experience like traveling down in the Atlantic conveyor? And then, when you got to the end, how did you decide? And what was it like to go from the Atlantic? Decide who would be going to which carrier? And how did you decide? And what was it like transitioning from the Atlantic conveyor, which is sort of the closest I can think of would be a Mack ship from World War II, a converted merchantman, to the proper carriers? Was it far? Did it make things easier? Did it make things difficult? Were they cramped? Were they hospitable? What was it like?
Atlantic conveyor was that was very interesting. I mean, the ship was complemented for something like 32 people. That was the total crew. We put something like 160 or so in addition. So there were people sleeping in the day cabins. We had a lot of porter cabins on board. I actually shared the master's day cabin with the CO of one of the Wessex squadrons. We were right up the top of the ship, and we had endless discussions with Captain North, who sadly was died when the Atlantic conveyor was struck. But it was a very interesting time, and we were well looked after. I think one of my irritations at that stage was that I'd paid all my mess bill and laundry bills in cash. And if I'd had any sense, I would have paid by check, because the check would have gone to the bottom of the sea and my cash went to the bottom of the sea. But apart from that, it was a very comfortable passage down. I kept one aircraft on alert, ready to go from a vertical takeoff, armed with a missile, in order to have a go at the shadowing aircraft. At this stage, the Argentines were using a commercial 707 aircraft, using its cloud avoidance radar in the surface search mode, and they were clearly tracking the British fleet going south. And they'd been warned off before. They'd been shadowed by 800 squadron aircraft on the way down. Eventually we got rules of engagement which would actually have allowed it to be shot at. I was pretty determined that if anybody was going to shoot at this airplane, it was going to be me. So I actually did spend a while on immediate readiness to launch, to go and shoot at it. Now, contrary to what a lot of people had said, and we'd offloaded the guns and the one missile off the Sea Harrier, my maximum range from a vertical takeoff to go and shoot at a 707 was 183 miles. In other words, I would go out 183 miles, shoot a missile, and then come back and do a vertical landing. And I think that sort of brings it home to a number of people that was just about possible at that stage. This was that was the capability that we had in the Sea Harrier. So, but just going on from that, actually getting the aircraft into the Hermes and Invincible, that was really decided for me, that we would send four aircraft to Hermes and four to Invincible. When it actually, the RAF 6 GR3 aircraft would actually go to Hermes, as had been planned anyway. So when it came to actually transferring the aircraft, I launched from Atlantic conveyor. The Hermes was almost alongside us, so it was a very easy transition to land in Hermes. And I then refueled in Hermes, and that same evening, by which time it was dark, I actually flew on to Invincible. As an aside on that particular trip, I had no idea of use of the radios. We hadn't had any briefings, of course, in the war zone. We didn't know to what extent radios were being used. I really didn't know whether we would be lights on in the aircraft or lights out in the aircraft, whether I should be flying at low level or high level. We just didn't know what the routines were, and I was pretty determined I wasn't going to be shot at and mistaken for an Argentine aircraft. So I eventually decided I'd fly at sort of medium level and put all the lights on and use the radios, which is exactly what I did. When I arrived in Invincible, I actually weren't expecting anybody, so somehow they hadn't got the message that that I was on the way. So I appeared, called them up, and landed. And I think they were kind of surprised to see me. But actually, the transfer of all the aircraft out of Atlantic and to the two ships went pretty well without interest. I have to say that one of the RAF exchange pilots did a pretty peculiar takeoff, vertical takeoff. But he made it to just and landed in Hermes without further incident.
You say peculiar. What happened?
Well, it was what he left. One of the things you do when you launch a Sea Harrier is you check the engine power with the nozzles at about 40 degrees before you put the nozzles down to 90 degrees. And you need to get the order of advancing your left hand with the nozzle lever and the throttle in the right order. And he actually left the nozzles at 40 degrees and advanced the throttle to maximum. So the aircraft did what was termed a 40-degree launch. One of the things in a Harrier, of course, is you've got much more thrust than you have weight. So you actually go very fast opposite to the direction the nozzles are pointing in. And so he headed very quickly towards the guardrails. We'd left the guardrails on the side of Atlantic Conveyor for quite good sort of safety reasons. And he was clearly going to impact these guardrails. So he rotated the whole aircraft into the vertical position in order to have the nozzles pointing down, as opposed to putting the nozzles vertically down. And then realized that that wasn't going to work. So, but he cleared the guardrails at this stage. So he then must have pushed the stick forward. So he then left a huge furrow in the sea and lots of water. And I thought we'd actually lost the airplane. But anyway, he made it aboard Hermes and all was not lost.
Sounds like you had a fun time. Right, so you've now got to the squadron, to the carriers. How is it like integrating with the ships and carrying out operations from them? How did you get involved in the operations? What was sort of the structure used, and how was supportive were the ships to doing it?
I think my sort of recollections of the the operations itself, where there were a mixture of waiting very long hours for there's something to happen, and then, of course, intense activity when you were airborne. But my overall recollection really is that we weren't doing anything new. We'd trained for this. We had excellent equipment in the form of the Sea Harrier. All the maintenance teams were really first class. They all knew exactly what they were doing. They got on with the job. And the end result was that virtually 100% of planned missions were actually flown with fully serviceable aircraft. And this ran across both 800 and 801 squadron, both the ships. Any problems we had really stemmed from the inadequacies within the task force. In particular, we had no airborne early warning. And there was also very little close-in weapon system capability against attacking aircraft in many of the ships, let alone the carriers. The Sea Harrier, we could have done with larger fuel tanks. We could have done with more missiles on the aircraft. And we needed a self-protection system, flare and chaff dispenser. Now, all these things actually came very soon after the Falklands War. We actually used chaff in the aircraft by fitting chaff in the closed air brake, and then by extending the air brake, this released the chaff. This, of course, only worked on one occasion. And I have to say it was prone to misuse. People would put the air brake out and dispense chaff at the wrong time. Having myself locked the radar onto what I thought were two Argentine aircraft to find that it was chaff, that was a case in point. The Sea Harrier itself lacked a look-down capability over land and over rough seas. That's with its radar. So CAP, Combat Air Patrol missions, were often flown at low level, looking up. And indeed, that was the best way of using the radar, was in a level or look-up mode. But I think, given their shortcomings, I think we were extremely lucky that the Argentines didn't adopt tactics that I think we would have done. Had they, for instance, attacked in large numbers, we would have had huge problems. We simply didn't have the numbers of aircraft to deal with them. Bear in mind that they had, at the time, over 200 combat-capable aircraft, and we'd started off with 20. So we were something like 10 or 11 to 1 against. Now, those are unfavorable odds by anybody's imagination. The great strength of our operations was, I think, that we tended to launch aircraft on missions when intelligence suggested that incoming raids were expected. So that was a great advantage to us. And the other real advantage was they tended to launch penny packets of aircraft, certainly no more than four at any one time. Now, to me, their disadvantage was that they had none of the sort of background training that we had enjoyed. With the very large numbers of aircraft they had at their disposal, they really should have done better. Or at least they should not have lost in the air to the extent they did. I mean, we shot down something like 24 of their aircraft to zero Sea Harriers lost in air combat. And there's nothing wrong with the Mirage 3 or the Skyhawk, for that matter, in Mirage 3 in air-to-air terms. The Israelis had proved that already. So to my mind, this purely comes down to poor training coupled probably with a lack of appreciation of what the enemy, what we might be doing. Another example, I think, having looked at the results of their results in a great deal of detail in the years afterwards, I'm seriously surprised that they had not practiced their low-level weapon release. After all, we had actually sold them the bombs and the fuses that they were using. In addition to that, the BBC World Service had actually broadcast that their bombs were not fusing on impact. Anybody with any sort of AWI training knows that the release parameters in low-level bombing, they're absolutely essential. And any bomb dropped with those particular fuses at something like below 180 feet or so would never fuse. Now, any fool can get a bomb onto a target by flying very low level and releasing the bomb as you get to the target. The danger, of course, is that if the bomb explodes, it will blow the aircraft up. So you have to drop from some way away and get the aircraft out of the fragmentation pattern of the exploding bomb. A lot of people have said to me after the war that they thought the Argentine pilots were very brave by flying so low. To me, that's complete nonsense. To me, somebody flying that low, it's a sign of fear. They should have been at 200 feet, gritting their teeth, flying through whatever was being fired at them, not flying at 50 feet, trying to avoid the flak. Had they flown at 200 feet and done a proper weapon release, their bombs would have gone off and we would have had serious problems. A lot of the bombs that hit the ships did not explode. We've covered the bit about actually splitting the squadron, the two ships. I actually flew off both ships. Most of my time was spent in Invincible. There was a marked difference between the two ships. Hermes was larger and had a eventual total of 16 Sea Harriers, and eventually 10 Harriers were embarked. They lost of that total, they lost six, and they had an initial complement of 9 anti-submarine warfare helicopters. But actually, they dispatched these helicopters around the RFAs to make room for the fixed wing aircraft. Invincible, by contrast, had initially 8 Sea Harriers, and then I put an extra 4 into that. They had 12, and then actually 4 were lost. But they retained the complement of 11 ASW Sea Kings. So I think by way of comparison, I think Invincible was actually much more comfortable. She wasn't overloaded with people to the same extent that Hermes was. As far as I was concerned, the main difference in Invincible between the peacetime operation and wartime was that there was always seemed to be food available in the wardroom whenever you wanted it, on a self-service basis. In Hermes, things were rather different, as people were actually using the wardroom as accommodation and actually sleeping in. So the normal sort of wardroom activities were somewhat curtailed. Invincible, for instance, showed films in the evenings. The bar was open. Not that many people actually drank very much, I think, but things were normal. And there's a message, I think, when you go to war, you need to go to war the way you've practiced it. And Invincible was actually, throughout Operation Corporate, was, to my way of thinking, not too much different from the way we practiced.
Thank you. So, one of the things I know is I know from talking to you that at some point you also end up going from flying Harriers, from commanding a squadron, to talking with Sandy Foff 1 staff, who's the rear admiral who's down there in Hermes, and then going ashore. Can you explain how that happened?
Yes, it was the day that Galahad was bombed, the Welsh Guards and all that ghastly episode took place. And I was actually airborne over the ship soon after the bombing, too late actually to do anything about the attacking aircraft. But when I landed back aboard Invincible, I was actually told that I had to get out of the ship. I was to go over to the flagship, to Hermes, and then I was to be prepared to go ashore. Which really surprised me. As a sort of squadron CEO, I felt that I was my place was actually in the airplane. Bear in mind, we were working up towards the end of the war. Things were going our way. And anyway, when I got to Hermes, we'll just go back a stage at that. One of the things I had done before when we embarked all our kit to go south was we really didn't know exactly what we were going to do. And I had my few years with the Royal Marines 4 years earlier had equipped me to knowing a little bit about what living in the field was all about with the Royal Marines. So I'd actually packed in my trunk a load of sort of come in handy gear, which included some of the sort of you can't see me type gear that the Royal Marines wear. So I rapidly packed some of this into a small bag, got in the helicopter, went over to Hermes, and the Admiral Sandy Woodward sat me down, fed me a large glass of whiskey, and told me in very simple terms, this being now my second succinct remit in a few weeks, he said, go ashore and go to Fearless and sort out the problems that we're having tasking the Royal Air Force Harriers. Basically, they were receiving out-of-date instructions and arriving at targets that were either not there or they were heavily defended when they didn't expect them to be heavily defended. I was inserted into San Carlos, and that was interesting to say the least. But I found myself the following morning aboard Fearless, and actually, again, in familiar territory. I'd been with the Royal Marines. We'd done all the exercises in Norway. We'd worked with FOF3 and with the Commodore Amphibious Warfare Staff. At that time, I'd been part of the Royal Marines staff. And I was back in the amphibious ops room, seeing what on earth they were doing. It was immediately obvious to me that the problem stemmed from the way that the Royal Air Force were actually tasking their aircraft. And they had insisted on, for reasons that I've never really understood, on actually sending a wing commander down to Fearless to actually run what essentially was, as I think he would have seen it, a divisional tasking organization, which would have worked fine in the central plains of Germany, where you have divisions and multiple airfields, and you need a divisional tasking organization. It clearly was a nonsense to run this in Fearless. That wasn't the way that the three commando brigade or the amphibious warfare staff ran things. And I'd done the job as the air tasking officer in Fearless. What he was trying to do was to actually task aircraft using signal message traffic as opposed to real-time voice traffic. And signal message traffic in the Falklands was taking an awfully long time to reach the destination. In fact, some of the signals he sent were taking 12 hours to actually get through. And in air tasking terms, this is a complete nonsense. It needs to be real time. And again, I think this perhaps stems from the initial decision that was made to not send the FOF3 staff, although I don't think, maybe that was not the case particularly. But I think it comes from people were trying to do something. They'd thought up their own ways of doing things, and they weren't actually doing things by the book. And there's a huge danger of this in wartime. I was genuinely surprised that the rules that we had practiced, the ways that we practiced, weren't being adhered to. The Allied Tactical Publication number 8, ATP 8, was, if I remember rightly, was the sort of Bible for amphibious operations. And it covers all this in very great detail. I'm not sure that ATP 8 was, a lot of people even knew of its existence. So I think that was the problem. Now, what I suggested to the wing commander was that actually he should go ashore with the brigade and talk to the aircraft directly using their communications. And if he needed to go to the top of Mount Kent, for instance, that was where he should be. He actually told me at the time, which I think really surprised me, he couldn't possibly get out of the ship because part of his duty was to talk to northward on the scrambler phone, the bubble phone as it was known, and he had to talk to his three-star air commander at Northwood every afternoon at 3 o'clock. What a complete nonsense this was. I mean, that's what he told me. So he said he couldn't possibly go. At that stage, I said, well, okay, I will go. He outranked me. He was a wing commander. I was a lieutenant commander. And I think, again, that probably accounts for some of the problems, because I suspect that people couldn't tell him things, even if they knew he was doing it wrongly. I think that there's a sort of serious message to this, that you can't have different people talking to different people back home. You've got to have one person in charge of an operation, and everyone must know to whom they're reporting. There can only be one boss, and I think that this is again stems. This comes back to the overall sort of task organisation. I don't know whether this has cropped up in other conversations, but I think that the task organisation down there, it worked, but it actually was not ideal, and I don't think it was being done in accordance with the way that we had all practiced it. So you come back to this very basic point that actually, if you're going to go to war, you need to do it the way you've practiced. We made, at the end of the day, I guess we made fewer mistakes than the enemy did, and thank goodness for that.
I think it would have made more sense for Vice Admiral Derek Raffel, the FOF-3 he was talking about earlier, to have gone south as Task Force Commander instead of having a Task Force Commander back in Norfolk. It seems to me from everyone I've talked to and everyone I've discussed this with, especially in these podcast series, is that if you'd had such a command down there and a Task Force Commander down south, then a lot of the communications problems with different units communicating back with Norfolk when they should have been communicating with the command structure down south and the different task group commanders receiving confusing commands would have been stopped there. And that is what the county class destroyers were designed for in many ways. Even if he wasn't going to be on HMS Hermes, he could have been stuck in a county class. He could have been down there and he could have been wandering around the task groups quite happily, sorting out problems and basically being the single point of contact so that the task group commanders could have got on with fighting the war and he could have dealt with Northwood and made sure the task group commanders were working together.
I think you're absolutely right. I think where I would perhaps differ slightly is that Raffel should certainly have been there. He had been the Commodore Amphibious Warfare in a previous job, so he knew exactly what he was doing. And he owned the carriers and the amphibious ships, as you might say. I would have put him in HMS Hermes. If you want another task group commander, then one of the other ships would have been fine.
Okay, so we've now got to the point where you're ashore, you're directing all this, but your war doesn't stop sort of there, from what I see, because you then go back. You have all these operations, you're doing coordinating things with the brigade, which must have been a really hectic job, and anything you can remember from there in your time ashore will be really great to hear. But then after that, you go back to the UK, form up a squadron again, and bring it south again.
Yes, at about 20 to 4, I think it was, I can't remember the exact time, but I noted it down in my log, I was actually twiddling my thumbs in the amphibious ops room in Fearless, and one of the radio nets came the voice message that I can see white flags flying, and then somebody else piped up and said they could see white flags flying. So at that stage, the attacking RAF Harriers that were coming in with laser-guided bombs, one of the early LGB missions, that was called off. So that was the end of the end of the war, or at least that was the beginning of the end of the war. I went into Stanley a day or so later. The ship went round to off Stanley, and we looked to see what state the airfield was in. We looked for places that we might operate Harriers from, Sea Harriers from, and the RAF Harriers. We looked at the race course, for instance, in Stanley, which clearly was unsuitable, and the obvious place was to put them on the airfield. I actually walked the length of the runway at Stanley with 10,000 Argentine prisoners not too far from the runway, which I found quite disconcerting. In fact, I got a Lynx helicopter to hover between me and as I walked the runway looking to see what damage there was on the runway. The hole on the side of the runway that had been filled in, that was the Vulcan bomb hole. That had been filled in. There was a dummy crater that they'd shoveled earth to make it look as though there was bomb damage. And that was clearly earth shoveled. I think they just brushed it away every evening and used it, used the runway. So the runway itself was actually not badly damaged at all. I then went, transferred to Hermes, spent a couple of days in Hermes, and then transferred to the tanker, the British Y, went back to Ascension in British Y, flew back to the UK, and reformed 809 Squadron, this time with 12 aircraft, and we had brought Illustrious out of the builder's hands very quickly, commissioned her, and so Illustrious and my 12 aircraft plus helicopter squadron, we went down, and we got down in late August down to the Falklands, and we were able to relieve Invincible that then came back. Hermes, of course, had come back earlier. And so we were then down there until the Royal Engineers had rebuilt, or they'd laid AM2 matting on the Stanley Airfield and extended the runway and enabled the Royal Air Force Phantoms, they were, to actually go down to provide air defence of the islands. And as soon as the Phantoms arrived, they flew down in flight refueling from Ascension Island, again a sort of 9-hour mission. And as soon as they arrived, we dispatched Illustrious and came home. That was an interesting few months. It was, of course, the shooting war was over, but we didn't quite know what was going to be happening. And we were very much prepared for operations. I kept a couple of Sea Harriers ashore to provide air defense. The RAF had a squadron or detachment ashore on the airfield. So we used some of the same facilities. Although I have to say, we'd actually asked the Naval Air Squadron is not equipped to live in the field when operational. It's in a ship, and that so you don't need tents and camping equipment in the Naval Air Squadron. We'd actually asked the RAF if we could have some tents and equipment so we could disembark Sea Harrier Squadron. And this had been flatly refused. They said they didn't have any to spare. which I found quite astonishing. This was signals being sent from HMS Illustris back to MOD. So actually in high dudgeon, I went ashore and booked some rooms in the Upland Goose Hotel. So I actually moved my team into the Upland Goose Hotel. We commandeered a captured Argentine some vehicles and enjoyed ourselves being living ashore in a hotel while the RAF squadron were actually living in a quagmire in on the airfield. And I don't think they ever really forgave me, but it actually was not it wasn't their making. Who made that decision back in MOD is totally beyond me.
It seems to me some bit of serious bureaucracy got involved in that point. So, we've talked a lot about the Sea Harrier. What was it like to fly?
It was, I think, quite the most exciting of all aircraft that I've ever flown. I had roughly the same amount of flying time in sort of four main types, in the Sea Vixen in the 60s, in the Phantom in the 70s, a lot of Hunter flying, both single and two-seat Hunter flying, and then in the Sea Harrier. So, you know, I had these sort of four types under my belt. The Sea Harrier was quite definitely, it was a pilot's aeroplane. It was a fantastic design. It came out of Sydney Cam's design field, design team. Sydney Cam, of course, had designed the Hunter, and the Harrier came out of the same stable. So I think they both rank as probably the best aircraft for any pilot to fly. But the great strength of the Sea Harrier was it was simple. And it was hugely effective. In its last form in the FAW-2 with the updated radar and AMRAAM missiles, it was quite exceptional. It was then everybody considered it to be the best fighter outside of the United States, certainly the best fighter in Europe. I mean, quite an astonishing capability for this very, very simple aircraft. And I mean, just going on from that, it's totally beyond me how we firstly gave away the FAW-2 Sea Harrier capability. And then we gave away the Harrier capability in 2010. I mean, it's beyond belief that we have given this capability away. I mean, going back to the Sea Harrier, yes, a remarkably good aeroplane, simple, everything normally worked, it worked a dream, it was a pilot's aeroplane.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a couple of questions now. What were the biggest challenges you faced during the Falklands conflict? What were the biggest challenges you had?
I think the biggest challenge was probably it's a difficult question to answer because there's always a challenge getting any organized prepared for war. But it wasn't as big a challenge as you might think, because we'd done it before. We had trained endlessly. We actually did know what we were doing. My background was almost totally in the air warfare world. We had this great sort of history. One of the things that we'd in the air warfare world we'd got involved with was actually in the late 60s was setting up the United States Navy's Top Gun School at Miramar in California. Now I wasn't personally involved, but people I was working with in the AWI school at Lossiemouth were. When I went over to Top Gun in the early 70s, I was just to visit. The CO of the Top Gun School actually showed me the air weapons, air combat maneuvering manual that they used, which is a sort of inch thick manual. And on the front cover, it had two quotations. The top of the page was a quotation by Baron von Richthofen, dating from the First World War. And at the bottom of the page, there was a quotation by Lieutenant R.S. Lord, Royal Navy, dating from around 1968. That sort of gave a clue as to the input that we'd actually had in setting up Top Gun. I think you have to ask, why was it? And the answer to that was that when the United States Navy or American forces in Vietnam started firing weapons, they found that a lot of their weapons didn't work. The reason that they weren't working was that the pilots were insisting that they'd fired within range and within the parameters of the missile. And in fact, in reality, they'd actually been firing outside the range. So they needed a serious organization to actually teach air combat and to insist on the standards. They didn't have it, at least to the same extent. The one organization that did actually have a squadron dedicated to this was the Royal Navy, and in the form of our AWI school at Lossiemouth. So that was how we ended up sending crews over to Miramar to set this up. And Dickie Lord, who I knew very well, he'd been instrumental in this. He sadly died 3 or 4 years ago, but he went on to very high rank in the South African Air Force. So there was that sort of background. Now, the challenges that that I had were really actually trying to step back from what we were doing and think what it was we wanted, to think, in a sense, to try and think outside the box. Actually doing the job, actually flying and fighting the aircraft, was not itself the challenge. The challenge was to try and outthink the enemy. As I say, the bottom line of it all was that we won. So to that I can be extremely grateful for. But I think we won because we were better trained, and I keep coming back to this point, we were better trained than the opposition. And I think, to be quite honest, the Argentines blew it by not having the right sort of training. Now, how that was came about is something I can't really comment on.
And my next question, what did you do afterwards? What was your career after the Falklands War? What did you carry on and do?
Oh, I went back to immediately went back to the MOD. In fact, the following year, I was immediately after the war, I went to do the Royal Air Force Air Warfare course. It's kind of a strange appointment, but that was a 6-month course at RAF Cranwell. That was interesting. And then following that, I went down for another 6 months to Stanley in the Falkland Islands. And I was the Queen's Harbour Master and was told very explicitly that I was not to mention the word aeroplane. So I dealt with the, and this was really getting the whole of the Falkland Islands back to a sense of normality. When I arrived, it was still in some chaos. By the time I left 6 months later, a huge amount of work had been done in getting things back to sort of normal operations. And a lot of people down there, the beginnings of the plans were underway to build the airfield at Mount Pleasant, and there was a new harbour at Mare Harbour was going to be constructed. So an awful lot of the sort of planning and implementation of that was beginning. And then I went to the MOD for the inside of 3 years. I got very involved in the doing the work with the update of the Sea Harrier, bringing the AMRAAM and the new radar into service in the FAW-2. And also my first task up there was to actually draft the naval staff target for the Sea Harrier replacement, which has now, of course, become the F-35, F-35B. So that involved a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with Washington, where I work very closely with my counterpart in the U.S. Marine Corps, the desk officer there for their replacement. And it's worth saying that the in-service date initially for the replacement was 1997. Now, this airplane is going to come into service in the early 2020s, so there's a bit of a time difference there. But that started in 1984, writing that naval staff target. And I followed the whole progress of the F-35 quite closely. After 3 years in MOD in London, I went over to Washington on the staff of the embassy there, and of course continued my interest with the with that aircraft. And then I was last few years I was back in FOF 3 staff as the aviator and FOF 3 staff again in the 90s, and spent the last few years of my naval service in London in the central staffs before retiring, and I founded a school of boat building in Lyme Regis. So that was my sort of history since the Falklands.
From ace fighter pilot to school of boat building, that is an interesting, that is a great title for biography. Well, here's the final question. So from your career, as it's been quite so extensive, not just the Falklands, are there any lessons that you wish you'd known before you'd gone to the Falklands, earlier points in your career that you now, looking back, know, and that you think others would benefit from knowing?
I think a lot of it I have actually covered. I'd venture to say that, as far as I'm concerned, in the during Operation Corporate, we learnt very few new lessons, rather we learnt, relearnt a lot of old ones. Now, a lot of people have said this, and to give you an example, I think, of the shortcomings of the ships themselves, these weren't new, but we'd somehow forgotten. We'd forgotten things like the fact that aluminium burns in ships. If you make a superstructure out of aluminium and then get it very hot, it actually doesn't just melt, it actually burns. We learnt that synthetic clothing on people in extreme heat, it actually melts onto their skin. Now, this wasn't new. We used synthetic clothing because it was easy care. But actually, in a sort of flash fire situation, we needed to have traditional type clothing, I mean, cotton or whatever, and not man-made fibers. I think we learned in the ships, when ships were burning, that smoke and fire are totally deadly, and we needed far more breathing apparatus kits around the ships. Now, most of this came in very, very quickly after the Falklands. In the air, I think we learned that that a fleet is potentially extremely vulnerable without proper airborne early warning. We also learned, I think, that fighter aircraft really should have sort of electronic countermeasures built in. We needed more fuel in the Sea Harrier, and actually we arguably really could have had it done with the capability to refuel in the air. But of course we didn't have any tankers down there. We learned that the radar in the Sea Harrier needed to be able to discern targets over the land and over rough seas. And so forth. Now, most of those sort of defects were rectified after the war, after the Falklands War. So But they weren't new lessons at all. I think we knew that. We somehow sort of put them to one side. Maybe they were too difficult. Or we had perhaps forgotten them. I have one worry, I think, from 1982, and that is I'm not convinced that all the messages, all the lessons about command and control have been properly hoisted in. And this comes back, I think I've covered it a number of times in our discussion, that we actually need to practice these things. You need to practice all the procedures and the command and control with the actual people who are going to be doing it at the time. And you need to write proper manuals on how to do it. Indeed, the manuals I know are written. But we need to adhere to those manuals in war. And people don't need to have another idea or better idea of how to do things when push comes to shove. It's absolutely crystal clear to me that a naval task force commander has to have complete control of all the assets that he has. And I think it's worth saying that a naval task force commander has just a colossal array of systems at his disposal to prosecute a target or to achieve his objective. And these range from submarines through surface ships to aircraft. All of these systems have different weapons systems on board. As a naval aviator, I've always been very content to be just a part of an overall naval weapon system. I fully accept that at times I will be used, and at other times there may well be a better system to use. I mean, for instance, land attack missiles fired from a submarine may be a much better answer than actually doing an air-to-surface weapon fired from an airplane. That's, I think, the sort of viewpoint of all naval aviators. We're happy to be part of that system. I have to say that actually, if you wear a light blue uniform and you're in the Royal Air Force, your starting point is an airplane. You're not too concerned about submarines or land attack missiles fired from surface ships or whatever. Your starting point is the airplane. It might or might not in the future have a pilot in it, a man in it, but that's your starting point. And I think it's essential when we start thinking about how we're going to operate the new class, the huge 60,000 ton aircraft carriers, Queen Elizabeth class, we have to work out how we're going to operate it. It is going to be absolutely no good at all if we start having Royal Air Force people in a carrier who are working to a different boss other than the Naval Task Force commander. They've all got to be integrated as part of the one force. And that, I think, this is a doctrinal thing. And I think that doctrine has got to be properly written and properly adhered to. And ad hoc arrangements simply will not work. And I would say that actually, if you're going to have aircraft at sea, which, of course, we will in the aircraft carriers, those aircraft have got to be totally familiar with what's going on. They've got to be worked up. They've got to be there for considerable lengths of time. So putting penny packets for short duration periods is never going to work. They've got to be properly part of the ship. As a naval aviator, my fitness report, my 206, was written by the captain of the ship that the squadron was attached to. And that's a very, very important point. It was not written by the captain of the air station that was treated as a second line job. My reports were signed by the captain of the ship. And I think that's a very, very important point. And that lesson, I think, needs to be properly hoisted in by people currently writing the new rules for the QE class. I think that ad hoc arrangements, as I've said, they simply don't work in my view. And anybody who actually gets into a command position in war. I think it almost, people need to be forced to read their history books and draw the right conclusions from it. I think there's a great lack of, I think it runs through politics generally, but people need to know the they need to know their history of what happened in previous conflicts, and they need to have the right conclusions. I think we were very lucky in 1982 that the Argentines were so badly trained. We were fortunate, but you make luck happen for yourself, I think. I think, as a closing remark, I think it's unlikely that this will happen again.
Yeah, thank you. That was amazing.